Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the deal struck on medical marijuana and what it means for the Prop 2 ballot initiative. Also, the money behind the battle over various initiatives, the launch of a mayoral campaign by a former Salt Lake City councilman, and more. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Benjamin Wood is in studio with us. Good morning, and welcome, Ben.
Good morning.
We've also got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevenson. Hello, and thanks for being here, Taylor.
Good morning.
And is it, sorry, Taylor Stevens, I'm sorry.
Every time.
Every time you come in here, this is what I'm doing. And finally, we've got George Pylon. Just kidding. George Pylon, Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist.
Just George. Good morning.
Thanks for being with us, George. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments about the stories we're covering today, call us at 801-355-8255 or post them at sltrip.com. We'll be starting with the deal struck on medical marijuana. Again, if you've got questions, 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. Ben Wood, yesterday a deal was reached on medical marijuana in Utah with a ballot initiative, Proposition 2, looming large in the background. So who struck this deal? Who are the players? And, well, what is it?
Yeah, essentially, I guess to put it simply, if you were supportive of medical marijuana, congratulations, you've already won. And if you were opposed, congratulations, you've already lost. The legislature has decided that no matter what happens in November, they have a bill that they're ready to pass in a special session in November. It would establish a medical marijuana program considerably more restrictive than what the initiative would do, but it would still make that available to patients under qualifying circumstances.
Does Proposition 2 mean anything anymore, this initiative?
That's kind of the question. On the one hand, we had people like former Senator Mattson saying, you know, voting for the proposition is an insurance policy. It'll show lawmakers that they really should follow through on this deal. On the other hand, we had the governor and the speaker essentially saying, it doesn't matter what you vote or don't vote for. This is the bill we're passing.
I mean, you still have to – it's a draft bill, and the governor's going to call a special session of the legislature to make this deal law. But doesn't that assume that, you know, the legislature en masse agrees with the deal?
It does assume that. And we don't quite know yet how much the rank-and-file members of the legislature were aware of this deal. We kind of posed the question. We didn't get a firm answer on whether or not Speaker Hughes had the backing of his caucus. So, yeah, there always is the possibility that they call the session. This thing doesn't get the votes. I mean, anything can happen. But at least at this point, they're fairly confident that this will be the law. There will be medical marijuana in the state. And it will be through this mechanism, not the initiative.
Okay. And again, the proposition's passing, though, might send a message that this is according to the people who are advocating for the...
Right. And the concerns among advocates is that if the initiative were to fail now, that might give critics and legislature cover to say, oh, well, we didn't need to strike this deal anyway because the support's not there. So the supporters are still saying vote for Proposition 2, send that message, get that insurance policy in place.
I mean... And you have the LDS Church on board, heavy hitters here in the state of Utah and at the legislature. You could assume that that would mean that it would pass, I guess. Are there guarantees, though? I mean, what if, you know, someone amended the bill in the middle of this special session and said, actually, we're going to limit this to people who have blue eyes or whatever? I mean, that's a possibility, isn't it?
Everything is a possibility. Okay. There are no guarantees in state government. When they do convene a special session, they can amend, they can gut, they can throw it out. They can do just about anything except pass a completely unrelated bill.
What are the differences between the proposition that we were going to be voting on, that we'll still be voting on, and what this compromise does?
The big difference is the dispensary format. If you've ever been to Colorado or many of our neighboring states that have these dispensaries, you know you can go in. There's a wide variety of products, varying quantities, varying styles, in flower form, oils, you know, waxes, et cetera. What this bill would do is you would go to the county health department or one of a handful of what are being called cannabis pharmacies, and everything would be in dosage form. So even if you were to get marijuana in flower form, it would be in a blister pack like Eclipse gum so that you could just pop out a dose per day.
Okay. Okay, so that's one. I know that also there were some... you know, getting rid of the grow your own provision, which was something that was in the proposition and is not in this deal. And tell us what the grow your own provision was.
Yeah, the grow your own provision was, you know, the supporters of the initiative never expected that to ever actually happen. But the idea there was if this initiative passes and if the state drags its feet, this grow your own provision would kick in as an insurance policy. So that was always meant as a trigger to get the state working on this and implementing this quickly. There was never an expectation that everybody would be out growing their own marijuana, but that's been eliminated completely in this new deal.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you were going to have dosed forms of, if you had to have it in, you know, these little packages or whatever, and you grew your own, how would you be consuming it is another question. I know that you're not supposed to be, you weren't originally and probably still are not going to be smoking marijuana to alleviate your...
Yeah, technically speaking, you're not allowed to smoke it. You're not allowed to do a number of things with it. I'd like to see how they expect to enforce that. I mean, if we're being honest, they don't expect to enforce that. Once you have this in the privacy of your own home, you know, if you're a qualifying patient, you're going to do with it what you do with it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll just turn to George Pyle here for a second and then come back to you in a second, Ben. The grand compromise between power players happening to affect a deal on medical marijuana. Last week on the show, Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce said this thing. She was sort of laughingly saying, you know, behind closed doors, like shocked that that would happen in the state of Utah. It's interesting, though. It's kind of the Utah way.
It is. And in a way, it's almost like this is, if you really want something to happen in Utah, you start an initiative process, you circulate a petition, but you don't really expect to go to the polls and win. It's a way to push the legislature to act. And that's what happened in this case. And it's almost like some old French politician was supposed to have said, there go the people, I must follow them because I am their leader. And so that's what they're doing here. They're looking, they're reading the tea leaves and looking and saying, this is going to pass. This, or it's highly likely that it's going to pass, and they will have taken the power away from us. We can't allow that to happen. So let's reclaim our power to be the, I guess you're not supposed to call it a smoke-filled room anymore, and we'll make the decision, we'll make the law, but we'll make it in such a way that it will mostly satisfy this rabble out here, and they'll go away and leave us alone. You know, and it's kind of happened with Count My Vote. It kind of happened with Our Schools Now. They threaten to put something on the ballot. They threaten to use the power of democracy to make legislation they want. And the legislature and the governor step in and they say, no, you can't do that. Only we can do that, but we'll do something that you like just to calm you down a little bit.
Right. One way or another, it's kind of moving the needle on a topic that is popular, right, or somewhat
and
popular.
And probably you're going to get to this with all the money that's involved. I mean, in pure theory, a referendum petition, you know, that's grassroots of the people government, in theory. In reality, you've got to have a whole lot of money to pay people to go out and gather these petitions and draft the initiative, gather the signatures on petitions, have the hearings around the state, do all that kind of stuff. So, and that takes a lot of money. Well, that's fine. That's the way politics works, you know, on all levels. But it also, again, kind of puts the lie to the idea that this is grassroots democracy.
801-355-8255 to join this conversation. Ben Wood, one thing we didn't get to is there a difference in the deal struck and Proposition 2 on who can access medical marijuana in the state of Utah?
That's another very good question. The description of the qualifying conditions is different. One of the big ones that stands out is chronic pain, which was in the initiative. In the new agreement, there is a line that talks about pain lasting longer than 2 weeks under certain circumstances. You know, there's a lot of questions here that we don't quite have answers to yet. You know, the way things are described, the initiative was broader. A larger pool of patients would have been able to access marijuana under the initiative than will be able to access under this new agreement. Exactly who that population is, I don't think we have that answer yet.
Ben, who was at the table for this negotiation, you know, this quote-unquote backroom negotiation that led to this deal that was struck? I know there's been some complaints about patients, for example, not having a seat at that table.
There have been. You know, the leadership of the initiative effort was at the table, but there are also other patients groups that aren't formally leading the initiative that were supporting the initiative that were not. I mean, for example, Truce. Christine Stenquist, I spoke to yesterday, her organization was not present at these negotiations. She's concerned about this agreement. She prefers Proposition 2. She's also said that, you know, she's willing to take a look and willing to keep working on these, you know, amendments and negotiations. But yeah, there were groups of patients, groups of interested parties who were not present just because of the limited nature of these negotiations.
Greg Hughes played a hand in bringing in bringing these groups together, the sides that did show up at the table, including, I guess, the LDS Church, you had one patients group, you said, and then, or the advocates for the proposition.
Yeah, the formal initiative organization was there.
Okay.
Greg Hughes, by all appearances, was the facilitator of these talks. He pulled in the church, the initiative group, the Utah Medical Association. He kind of made this happen.
House Speaker, he's announced that he's not seeking re-election. Will he still be around when this special session happens?
He will. He won't leave office until January, which will be when the regular session of the legislature convenes. This special session will happen before that. So you'll have several outgoing lawmakers who have a chance to vote on this before taking off.
Okay. Why was Greg Hughes doing this? Feather in the cap? We kind of all assume that he has future political ambitions. Is that part of this? Or I don't know. You obviously can't speak for him.
Yeah, I can't speak for that. I mean, there's any number of motivations you can read into this. For one thing, the LDS Church had called for a special session before the end of the year, and they kind of have a loud voice around here. And this bill that has been created tracks pretty closely with the statement they put out, too. They wanted medical marijuana in dosage form prescribed by a physician, and that's essentially what this is.
Mm. Are we leaving anything out of the story? Are patients, for example, how are they reacting to the news that there is this compromise that's been struck or this deal that's been struck?
You know, it's so hot off the presses, the ink's still wet, that I think people are still it's 120-something pages of somewhat obscure descriptions of conditions and processes and cultivation and distribution. People are still reading it. I'm still reading it. I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet. Yeah. So I think over the next few days/weeks, especially as the election gets closer, there's going to be more and more opinions coming out about whether or not this is a good deal.
And again, they say that they're not campaigning, both sides. But
they're de-escalating their campaigns. They have not ceased campaigning.
Okay.
And I'd say that's an important distinction.
Okay. Meanwhile, and just before we head to a break, Ben, I'd like to tackle another story that you covered, which is that there has been money pouring into the initiatives. Utah power players have been cutting checks to advocates and opponents of initiatives. And with Prop 2, which we've been talking about, as you just said, supposedly people won't be campaigning anymore or they'll be de-escalating. What happens to the money that's been given to these sides? Some big checks cut, and recently, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, in politics, you don't see money being given back very often.
Yeah.
So the checks that have been cut have been cut. What they do with that, I think, is anyone's guess. The various sides have said that they won't be doing as many ad buys, you know, TV, radio commercials. But does that mean they won't be knocking doors? Does that mean they won't be putting out materials? We don't really know. And particularly Drug Safe Utah, we asked Michelle McComber, the president of the opposition campaign, if she was planning to de-escalate. She didn't say no. She didn't exactly say yes either. I mean, there is this looming question about what scope the campaigns on either side will have for the next 4 weeks.
Hmm. Well, I guess we'll see in ad buys and commercials and what happens there. How about with other initiatives? Who are the big wigs or the fat cats, the moneyed people who are pouring money into the other initiatives out there? We've got Medicaid expansion, for example.
Yeah, Medicaid expansion, redistricting, those are still hanging questions out there on the ballot. You know, Gail Miller has been giving money to the various initiatives on one side or the other. We have donations coming in from national groups, from Better Boundaries has a long list of small individual donations. I mean, there's a lot of money still being spent and gathered to push these through.
Okay. And with only, a month now to go before we have the election coming through. Ben Wood, thank you very much for this. We're going to head to a quick break. And when we come back, we'll look at what Salt Lake City is trying to do to get ahead of the inland port. And the city's mayor gets her first challenger for the 2019 election. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in a minute.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cash Arts 2018 through 2019 national touring season, presenting Finding Neverland, Something Rotten, and The King and I. Ticket and seating information at casharts.org.
Saturday and Weekend Edition, twists and turns of the Supreme Court saga and what it means come November when Americans cast their ballots. Also, our Tom Bowman in Raqqa, Syria, and the story of a veteran trying to find his peace.
When I decided I was going to sew, I came home with that sewing machine and I was like, I'm going to do it right now.
And I literally just shook my head.
Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Jessica Nani, the social media and web management intern here at Utah Public Radio. While I don't do much reporting on the air, I have the pleasure of interacting with you, our listeners, on the web to help bring stories to you from beyond the air. Check us out on UPR.org, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and on our app for news updates, community event information, award-winning.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Benjamin Wood and columnist George Pyle. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, to some news from Salt Lake City, and this is kind of an easy one to get out of the way. Mayor Jackie Biskupski now officially has her first challenger for her seat. Almost definitely not her last, though. Who are we talking about here?
So former Salt Lake City Councilman Stan Penfold, who left office in January, has issued a campaign to kind of unseat Biskupski. And when we're talking about this race, everybody's kind of focused on 2018 midterms, which are in about a month right now.
Right.
This, to be clear, is going to be a next year race. So 2019 is when we'd all vote on this. So not sure that it's top of mind for most voters right now, but Penfold really wants to kind of get out into the field early, and he says that this race really isn't as far away as we think it is, because, you know, the primary is in June, ballots are mailed out before that, so he wants to, I think, be the first out in the field to challenge Biskupski and get his name out there and
get a jump on campaigning, essentially.
Right.
Be
fundraising, campaigning.
He's got, you know, some name recognition from his time on the council, I guess. What else does he have going for him? Does he have endorsements coming in? I don't know if this was in the story.
I think that it's too soon
early
for that.
Okay.
I mean, he does, you know, he had 8 years on the council, 2 terms. When he left the council, he was the longest serving council member. So he's got the experience behind him with a really young council right now. So he's got that going for him. He is trying, you know, to get out. Here's the things that I accomplished when I was on the council. And what he said when I asked him, you know, why not another year as a council, you know, another term on council, he said that he felt he was ready to just kind of jump in and provide new leadership for the city. And he said that he thinks Salt Lake City needs somebody who's going to listen to their concerns and is going to act on those. And he didn't at his campaign event yesterday. In January, he had been quite critical of the mayor and of her leadership, Jackie Biskupski. And yesterday, he did not come out and talk about her specifically. He tried to keep the event a little bit more focused on his own accomplishments. But I think that we will see that come out, and a lot of these people, as they continue to enter the race, really being critical of the current leadership.
You know, I want to get to who the other likely runs are. But first, did the mayor have anything to say about Penfold announcing? I mean, Mayor Jackie Biskupski.
Mm-hmm. So I did reach out to the mayor's office and received a prepared statement that did not address Penfold's run at all, and instead looked to kind of tout Biskupski's own accomplishments in the office. And so we don't really know what she's thinking about this run or about having a challenger so early on.
How about who else is likely to run? We've heard some names.
So David Ibarra, a business consultant, has already filed his campaign paperwork, from what I'm told, but he hasn't publicly announced.
Okay.
And so I wouldn't say that he's really a contender at this point. He's just kind of he's going to step into the race, but not right now. And so he confirmed to the Tribune yesterday that he would be running. And we've also got, so I called all of the names that have been floated for this race, Jim DeBacchus, a state senator who will be stepping down from that role. He said he's doing some soul searching and is still trying to decide. We've got David Garbett from the Pioneer Park Coalition, and he has also said, you know, that he's considering entering the race, but is leaning towards it, but hasn't really made a decision. So, and I'm sure that we'll see other contenders enter that we haven't even heard from yet.
Right. There's a lot more to the story. One of the things, the Tribune not that long ago, or somebody conducted a poll sort of looking at the race, potential contenders for the race, and seeing how Mayor Jackie Biskupski fared. And it was at that time not all that well against potential contenders.
Yeah, and so there have been two polls, actually. And again, it's very early.
Right.
You know, this isn't a race that's top of mind, so it could be too soon to say. But Utah Policy conducted a poll at the beginning of September that found, I think, 56% of likely Salt Lake voters said that they think that there should be a new face in the mayor's office. Another poll conducted in the summer of this year, I believe, so a couple months back, by Lighthouse Research, found that in a kind of a five-way race between Biskupski and some other contenders, that Debakis would receive kind of the bulk of the vote. Penfold received just 4%. When his name was in that five-way race. So I think he wants to get out there early, get some name recognition, get the jump. But, you know, again, it's early,
right,
and we don't know what we're going to see kind of as that campaign season ramps up.
George Pyle, as Taylor pointed out, we're not even to the 2018 midterm elections. But your thoughts, if you have any, on Stan Penfold's announcement that he's running.
Well, yeah, he was, as we say, on the city council for two terms, thinks he knows something about how city government works, has a lot of problems with the way the current administration has been doing things or not doing things. And, you know, this is a chance for him to get in and do this. And as we say, you know, it's kind of early, but he's got a long way to go to establish a name recognition, raise money, get people to endorse him and volunteer for him and everything. It's a long process, even at just the level of the mayor of a big city. It takes a long time to get organized. It shows, I think, that the current administration is not super popular. You know, mayors... doesn't matter how good a mayor you are, you're going to make mistakes and tick people off. People aren't happy with the way she handled the inland port creation. People are mad about the way they changed the big trash pickup. People are mad about, you know, and, you know, anytime you run over a pothole, it's the mayor's fault. So it's rough. Now, but when Ralph Becker ran for his second term, he drew one candidate, and his only issue was he was upset about the way they changed the traffic flow on 13th East. That's all he had. So he just coasted re-election. But then when he ran for a third term, it was like, I don't know, we're kind of tired of all this. Plus, he had mishandled some things over at the police department and everything. And so that was Jackie Biskupski's opening. You know, Ralph fatigue, let's do something else. We may have reached Jackie fatigue sooner.
Earlier, huh? Well, let's, you know what, let's leave this behind. You're right, it's a year away. We have one person who's dropped their name into the race, and well, a second maybe, and we'll come back to that at some point. But staying with the city and the mayor's office, some news on the inland port, which George just mentioned. Mayor Biskupski and the city are trying to craft some policies that they hope will address some concerns that they have about the port, environmental concerns in particular, I think. Taylor, how are they doing that?
So what is happening, just to back up a little bit, yep, is that when the legislature went into special session over the summer and made some tweaks to the bill after city council did some compromising there, what the state ended up doing is setting a deadline of December 31st for the city to make changes to its zoning amendments. Mm. And that sounds kind of convoluted, but what it is that the city is kind of portioned out into these different zones that allow different things in different areas. So one area might be zoned residential, while another area might be zoned for light manufacturing, warehousing, or something like that. And so this area that the legislature, the city would say, has been grabbed by the legislature, right? They don't have, they do have a master plan, the city does, for that area, but it doesn't necessarily allow for all of the kind of uses that an inland port would require, if you're following me.
Yeah.
So what the city needs to do is allow for inland port uses. But what they also want to do is set some restrictions when they're updating the zoning so that, you know, they can't see the inland port just do whatever it wants. So if they don't set regulations by December 31st, they completely lose the ability to regulate this area of land. And so they're working, just kind of, the mayor called it fast and furious, to set these regulations. A process like this takes time. It starts with the planning commission, or the planning division, who drafts things up. Now the planning commission has forwarded on to city council. And what they are looking to do, like you said, is address some of those environmental concerns. Among them, they want to make sure that, you know, they can't outlaw natural resources from coming through whatsoever.
That was in the bill that
right.
the state passed.
So that's, you know, the state has said you have to allow this, so they can't just ban that because they don't have, you know, they have to defer to the state. And they can't do more than what the state says they can do. But what they want to do is set some boundaries and say, okay, temporary storage, that means 30 days. And that means coal has to be covered. And it has to be, you know, it should be stored inside, but if it's stored outside, it has to be covered. And so they're really just trying to set some boundaries through a process that companies that are proposing, you know, more bigger environmental impacts would have to create an environmental mitigation plan and show here's how we're going to, you know, lessen health impacts, lessen environmental impacts, lessen impacts on the water.
So zoning amendments, I mean, zoning regulations being put into place by the city. Isn't the port, though, effectively not part of the city because of what the legislature did in its special site? I mean, the mayor pointed out the board could essentially just override what the city decides to do anyway. But these are sort of recommendations through policymaking to the Inland Port Board?
Yeah, I think that they hope that the Inland Port Authority Board will recognize that this was a power the legislature had given to the city to regulate and set these standards. But I think at the end of the day, they know that the Inland Port Authority Board could say, you know, we think 30 days, that's not long enough of a time. You really should allow it for 90. That would still be temporary, you know, because they're trying to set these standards. But I think that they know at the end of the day that the Inland Port Authority Board has the final say.
And you're talking about that, how long, you know, the temporary storage of natural resources and how long, you know, what that actually means. That's in the bill as well that created the Inland Port. So, I mean, we're talking about coal showing up, being there for 30 days or 90 days or whatever it is that gets decided, and then moving on, coal or whatever else it might be. Is that the idea when you're talking about temporary storage? Are things being moved from one, you know, train car to another? I guess I'm, you know,
It's hard to visualize, and I think that's the other, you know, challenge that the city is facing as it tries to push through these regulations on a really quick timeline is that they don't really know what the port is going to look like because the legislature has defined it kind of vaguely. And we're still in this conceptual phase. The Inland Port Authority Board hasn't done a business plan. They haven't done an economic development plan. And so they're really trying to regulate in some ways something that they kind of only vaguely understand.
What about a lawsuit? The last time we spoke, Taylor, the mayor had suggested that lawsuits were coming, though they might not be coming from the city itself. Is that something that you've heard anything on since then?
You know, I asked the mayor about this maybe last week and just said, have you heard anything? What's coming down the pipeline? And she is just confident that at some point something is going to trigger a lawsuit. And maybe that's at the point when things become a little bit more defined because right now they are vague. So we don't have any updates on that. And maybe there won't be a lawsuit, but I guess stay tuned.
And some of that might come from, as you mentioned last time you were on the show, that could come from environmental groups. I guess what are sort of some of the worst fears about what the port might do, Taylor? This is something you also reported on.
Yeah, so this land is located on 20,000 acres in the city's kind of westernmost area by the Great Salt Lake. And people are worried about the ecosystem there, that the Great Salt Lake is already under a lot of pressure and is already shrinking. And what is developing this area going to do to the lake? Is it going to, you know, if the lake dries up, then you've got all of the kind of sand and that can be blown around and have, you know, negative health impacts. People are also worried about congestion, increased traffic on the west side when we already have poor air quality and we're, you know, barely making standards for air quality as it is. And so creating this massive development is just going to, people fear, kind of up those considerations.
Yeah, historic mining in the area and what might be in the soil when the lake does dry up and blow into the city
right.
is a question for some.
The birds, you know,
right?
What's going to happen
Millions
to the migratory bird population. So there's a lot of fears not only on how this is going to impact, you know, Salt Lake residents in terms of air quality, but also how this is going to impact the entire ecosystem. Hmm.
George Pyle, again, you know, how this thing happened, it was the state taking control away from the local government through this bill in the, you know, at the legislature. Yeah. And the city is thereby left scrambling to do something, and this is what they're trying to do, is enact regulations that then the board will consider, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're giving them a few months to do a kind of a big zoning project that most cities, if given their druthers, would take 2 years to do. So they're basically setting the city up to fail and then turning around and saying, well, we don't like those regulations, we're going to make our own, or on a case-by-case basis, you know, if somebody wants to do something there to set coal cars on a siding for 4 months, and the city will say, no, you can't, and then they'll go to the Port Authority Board, and the Port Authority Board will say, of course you can. This is a port. That's what you do in a port. And, you know, we talk about, you know, ascribing motives to people and trying to get inside their heads. The fear, and I think very justifiably so, is the state wanted to take the power away from the city because the city cares about environmental standards and the state doesn't. And you can't say that this is why the state did it, but if that was their motive, this is what they would have done. This fits that scenario. We don't want all these environmental weirdos around getting in the way of us digging all these beautiful holes. And if the city were in charge by itself, they would listen to the environmental weirdos, and the state and its port authority won't.
What about, again, what about this argument that the state constitution prohibits, you know, the legislature from taking away this particular authority from the state of Utah?
Yeah, see, that was something I didn't really realize this, because everywhere I've ever lived, and this is just standard in the United States, state government trumps local government. State government creates local government and can tell it what to do and not to do. So you just take that as a given. Well, Ted Wilson comes along and says, hey, there's a clause in the state constitution that arguably says you can't do this. The state can't create a body to take power or revenue away from a city. And that's exactly what they've done.
That's the clause that Biskupski thinks may get triggered.
But wouldn't you would think that the people who would be most interested in addressing that clause would be the city itself, not necessarily these. I mean, the environmental groups have an interest in preventing it, but the city is the sort of you know, the entity withstanding in that argument.
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about last week, Biskupski can't be the one to do it because the city council has blocked her from filing a lawsuit on this issue. Yeah.
And then you get into the, I mean, you mentioned standing, that's very much it. And also you could have a situation where, like, the city would set its set of rules, the state would set their set of rules, an environmental group would come along and try and sue, and they would argue, well, you know, we haven't actually done anything yet, so you can't sue us because you're suing this amorphous idea. You have to wait until, like, we permit something that you don't like, and then you can sue us. Maybe it would be the argument. And then, but then at the other time, then they could also come right back around and say, well, you should have sued us at the beginning and you missed your chance, so now you can't sue us anymore. I mean, they'll come up with all kinds of arguments as to standing, as you mentioned, and who gets to sue us, who gets to make these decisions. And if the city council has decided that it's fruitless to sue them and they had a better the better option for the city was not to sue them and get some changes, which they got from the original bill, so the Port Authority is a little less powerful than it was before. The council thought that was a deal worth taking.
Yeah. And the mayor, not necessarily.
And the mayor, not necessarily. Yeah. So, but they cut off her purse strings on that. So, yeah, I may fall to somebody else who will have to establish standing, will have to establish that they've been damaged.
Taylor Stevens, meanwhile, I mean, this has been called the largest development project in the state's history, essentially. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm surprised nobody's made the inland pork joke yet. but I mean, fighting against that from whatever standpoint is fighting against a lot of interests. I mean, I guess.
Yeah, I think we have more questions than we have answers at this point. It's really early on. I think it's worth noting that with the zoning amendments, that has to go through council. So this is not a done deal yet. This is a proposal that the Planning Commission has forwarded onto the City Council. The council is expected to consider that sometime this month, and we'll have a public process on it if people have input or have comments. And it's worth noting that there was an extensive public process behind creation of this to begin with, in terms of different hearings and things like that. But people can come and they can give feedback in before the city council, before this is really a done deal.
Right. And then it could become a done deal and then just be undone by the state, but still not, you know.
That seems to be a theme today.
Okay. We need to take another quick break here in the show. And then when we come back, Senator Orrin Hatch draws criticism for sharing a statement about one of the women making accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And some news from the Love McAdams race. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
We were able to take whatever we could carry in our two hands.
At the beginning of World War II, the United States government forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans into prison camps.
We thought we were American citizens, therefore we were protected by the Constitution to continue to have the freedom, the liberty that all Americans have a right to.
Listen for Order 9066 from APM Reports.
Join us for this three-part series. Part two is Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
This week on Undisciplined, we are talking about the way newspapers impact the way people think and the ways pollution impacts solar energy. And if those things seem like they have nothing in common, well, that's the point of our show. Joining us will be Alex Kopik, who studies how op-eds impact reader opinions, and I M. Peters, who studies the impact of haze on energy production. The political scientist and the photovoltaic engineer. That's Undisciplined, Friday at 2.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Benjamin Wood, and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. The Salt Lake Tribune wrote an editorial about something that Senator Orrin Hatch did earlier this week. The senator tweeted out excerpts of an account by a Utahn, a man named Dennis Ketterer, who called into question one of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's accusers, or who was trying to call her accusation into question anyway. I'm going to summarize reporting done by the Tribune's Courtney Tanner on this, since she's not here in studio, and then we'll go to editorial page editor George Pyle. The gist of this story is that Ketterer said this woman, a woman who she said saw Kavanaugh and others sexually assault girls in high school years ago. Ketterer wrote this letter and gave it to Senator Hatch's office. The letter says this woman isn't believable because Ketterer dated her and she told him that she liked to have sex with multiple men at the same time, and that he was told she had psychological problems, and also that she didn't talk about Kavanaugh in the short weeks that he dated her. So Hatch tweeted out excerpts of this letter and got a lot of flack for it, people accusing him of slut-shaming and misogyny. And George Pyle, Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor, that's kind of how your editorial board saw it as well, right?
Yeah. No, I think, you know, the word we used was Daffy Duck's favorite, despicable. And it's just what it is. I mean, it was slut-shaming. The whole thing is just unbelievable. I mean, if you try to put this in a novel, nobody would buy it. So one of the women who accused nominee Kavanaugh of being present when sexual misconduct was going on, somebody comes along and says, oh, I dated her for a while. She didn't mention knowing him. Therefore, she's lying was the implication. Well, okay, one, this is textbook of why women don't report when they've been sexually assaulted or even been around when somebody else was sexually assaulted. This is why they don't tell people, because then it just blows back at them and they say, well, why didn't you resist, or what were you wearing, or why didn't you tell us before? You know, all this stacks up as to why they don't tell anybody, because of the reaction they get. Plus, The implicit point of this letter was, this woman talks to strange men in bars. She talks to them about certain sexual preferences that she has. Therefore, she is not trustworthy. That is, if that equation doesn't make sense to you, then there's no point in this letter even existing. The only reason to write this letter, the only reason to release this letter, is to imply that this particular woman is unreliable. And why is she unreliable? Because she talked to a fat man in a bar.
There's likely a double standard there. If a man says that he likes to sleep with multiple women at the same time, what does that have to do with his credibility when it comes to having witnessed a crime?
Right. I mean, that's exactly the whole thing about all kinds of sexual assault. They say, what were you doing? What were you wearing? Did you lead them on? Why didn't you report it before? And total effort to make sure that they're not believed, that nobody has to pay for anything they did, and total, I mean, it's all the cliches, you know, slut shaming and male privilege and all this thing. It's just the poster boy for this.
Senator Hatch, though, says this was about getting relevant information out there, you know, I guess in front of the public for them to make it. And Kavanaugh's defenders have been saying that, you know, his good name is being dragged around in the mud, and so they feel empowered to do the same, too.
This information is only relevant if you buy the idea that if a person has sex in 2001, then you're not supposed to believe them in 2018. And I mean, the whole thing made absolutely no sense unless you think that somebody did something a little weird a long time ago, and therefore their accusation against this person is therefore not valid. And that's just ridiculous.
Editorial board at the Tribune said that Hatch is, that Hatch should be ashamed of himself for having done
it. He should be ashamed of himself. Or whichever member of the Judiciary Committee staff actually did this. I mean, I don't know that he even saw it before it was out there. We don't know how these things work. And then he's walking down the hall yesterday, was it? And some, big things turn on who gets to who in the elevator in the Capitol. And some women are coming up to him and yelling at him for his conduct. And he waves them off and tells them to grow up. And again, just going out of his way to be insensitive.
I just don't know what to do with this story from here other than to move on to another story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. And so what I'll do is say thanks, George, and go to Benjamin Wood. Ben, a well-regarded political analysis site is calling the McAdams love race in Utah's 4th District a toss-up, that it could go either way. Who's making this? Who's saying this and why?
Yeah, this was the Cook Political Report, and they are one of the most well-regarded handicappers of elections in the country. They have a nationwide list of races that are either, leaning right or left, solidly right or left, and then they do have this toss-up category. The Mia Love McAdams race had slipped to lean R, and then this week it was downgraded further to a toss-up, which in Cook's, the way they describe that is, Mia Love still probably has the edge if you were putting money on it, but that it really could go either way at this point.
Okay. Does that square with the polling that we've seen on this race in terms of how close it is?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. The most recent poll was by Utah Policy. It had McAdams down by 3 points within the margin of error. So statistically, you could say it was a tie. You know, there's been polls showing anything from, near 10-point lead for Mia Love to this Utah Policy poll, which has it close to a dead heat. And, Utah, we don't have the volume of polls that you see in more competitive states. And so there's a lot that we don't know. But, for the Cook Political Report, they're looking at national trends as well. And they're seeing a lot of indicators that Democrats are well-positioned for November. And that starts to affect races like Utah's 4th Congressional District, where you have a tight margin, and if things start to shift more to the Democrats, that can really make a difference.
The New York Times also picked up on this race, and they have a headline today, Mia Love, sole black Republican woman in Congress, fights for her seat. They also cite the Cook Political Report on this as well. It's been kind of an ugly race thus far, some negative campaigning, Ben, because of how close this is.
Yeah, I mean, in Utah, we're not used to this level of competition in our federal races. It's typically a blowout. This is the closest we've had. I mean, obviously, Mathis in Love was pretty close.
Right.
And I mean, this seat has been closer than the other seats in the state.
Right.
But particularly this year, it's a competition. The likes that we don't typically see around the state. So yeah, you're seeing more attacks, you're seeing more negative ads. Outside of Utah, that's par for the course. Inside of Utah, it's maybe a little atypical. But yeah, we're getting down to the home stretch, and both candidates are really trying to get that competitive edge.
George Pyle, is this race more or less competitive than it has been? And I'm thinking also to something Ben said about the Jim Matheson days, but also the most recent election for Mia Love against Doug Owens. What do you see here?
Well, it does look pretty competitive. The polls go back and forth, and we don't have the sample. And as Ben said, we don't have 100 poll takers in here like you would in a swing district in Florida or something. But Ben McAdams has a lot of name recognition. He has, I talk about mayors make a lot of enemies. He's managed to make a lot of friends over the years among Republicans. He has to work with Republicans on the county council, among the various mayors in the city. A lot of those people just like his style and like what he's accomplished with Operation Rio Grande and some other things. People are nationwide. We're going back and forth on whether we're going to have a blue wave or not, on whether just generically people would rather vote for Democrats than Republicans for Congress because they're upset with the president and they want some kind of check and balance on the president, which is not just isolated to this maybe extreme president. All through history, the party in the White House almost always loses seats right. in an off-year election because people are saying, well, okay, this guy's in the White House and maybe I hate him and maybe I like him a little, but I like the idea of the other party having some power to balance that out. And this year, that might be stronger than usual.
Is this election, I don't know if this is a question for Ben or George, but is this election for Mia Love a referendum, you know, on Donald Trump as much as it might be for other candidates in other states? Is she, you know, tied in with what Trump is in the minds of Utah voters?
It's always hard to make a firm link, but one thing we have seen in the polling is that the less popular voters find Donald Trump, the more competitive the district becomes. So, for example, in CD2, which is not competitive, Chris Stewart is very much favored to win, but Shireen Ghorbani has tightened that race to a degree that we probably didn't expect her to, and a lot of that has been attributed to the unpopularity of Donald Trump. So clearly that plays a role in CD4. Donald Trump he's least popular in CD4 than the other areas of the state. And then, of course, you have a Republican in Mia Love and you have a Democrat in Ben McAdams. And if you're a voter, that has to be in your mind.
You know, Jim Matheson held this seat when it was sort of first created. He originally was in a different seat. Has gerrymandering had an effect on this seat and how, you know, how Mia Love's election originally? That's a great question for George Pyle.
Gerrymandering is, George can probably give you an answer. I can't tell you whether something is or is not gerrymandered. What we do know is Salt Lake County is split into three pieces. One of those pieces is in Mia Love's district, and it gets just enough Salt Lake County to not quite overcome some of those partisan differences. It's, again, I would just suggest to anyone who has a question about gerrymandering, just look at the way the map is drawn and come to your own conclusion.
That's what you have to do. George Pyle?
Yeah, no, it's gerrymandering. I mean, it's just...
That right there is the difference between editorial voices
and reporters.
It's not as bad as some of those things in, like, North Carolina and Virginia, where a congressional district, like, follows this interstate, and you have this... I mean, it was called gerrymander originally because it looked like a salamander, and this isn't this. This is the difference between having what they should have had was a congressional district centered around Salt Lake County, which is enough, more than enough people for a congressional district, and then you split the rest of the state into three mostly rural districts. That's the way most people wanted it done the last time. The state, to its credit, they had hearings all over. They had an interactive website. They had all these statistics in there that you could manipulate. So it was easy for anybody to go in, and with the kind of criteria that Proposition 4, is it, would like us to have, it let people do that math. And the way it should have come out was what we call the donut, where there's a competitive, if not probably not safe Democratic, but definitely competitive district, Salt Lake County, and then three safe Republican districts out in the rural area. Well, they didn't do that. They did what they called the pizza, so that Salt Lake County is carved up, sliced like a pizza, so that part of it goes to this mostly rural district, part of it goes to this mostly rural district, part of it goes to this mostly rural district, and it isn't enough to completely shut out the Democrats, but it goes a long way.
If, just for a yes or no question here, if this initiative passes and we have an independent redistricting commission, are we going to have a pizza or a donut in the end? What's going to anybody know?
They have been very adamant in saying they don't have a preferred outcome, but their guidelines do call for as compact and contiguous districts as possible and the preservation of cities and counties and communities of interest. When you read those guidelines, it's hard to not expect a donut district, which, to George's point, the state had a donut prior to 2000. You know, before 2000, there was a largely solid county district and then rural districts throughout the state. That was changed in 2000.
Right. The time has come for us to turn to our final segment of the show, Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Ben, thank you for your reporting on that last story. But let's go there. Who's ready with an underplayed story? Ben, why don't I leave
it
with
you? Yeah, I can go quick. Yeah. You know, this weekend is the LDS General Conference. Our religion reporter Peggy Stack had this interesting article about how in some congregations, young women are participating in an assistant kind of role to the passing of the sacrament, which is a task typically reserved for young men. But in some cases where there are mothers in nursing rooms, nursing areas, young women are taking the sacrament trays and passing it of sorts to those women. So sort of an interesting evolution of the way LDS culture is adapting to certain challenges. Peggy Stack has more on that.
Check it out. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, moving from religion to education, I guess. One point of interest is that the number of college students in Utah is almost as large as Salt Lake City's population now. Mm. We have a large number of college students, and also that five of those are now led by women who all came together yesterday to talk about what they see in the future for their colleges and also their experiences with sexism. So kind of two interesting education stories there.
Great education pick from Taylor Stevens. George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, just going off of that, the Astrid, is it Tumenez, is the new president of Utah Valley University. She came in to see the editorial board the other day. Just a delightful and very interesting person from the slums of the Philippines to BYU, to Harvard, to MIT, to Moscow, to Microsoft, and now here. But the thing that she and I had a lot of fun talking about was the fact that she is a big Doctor Who fan. And like, she is the first female president. We're going to have our first female doctor, I think, coming Saturday. She's kind of juiced about that. So I think the university is in good hands.
Well, it's about time for both of those things. I'm going to go for my pick for underplayed story of the week. I guess I'll go with the retesting of rape kits leading to a new conviction in a rape case. DNA from a rape kit that sat untested for more than a decade has implicated an already convicted murderer in the rape of a 16-year-old girl in Salt Lake City back in the year 2006. Anyway, success for an initiative to forward untested rape kits to the state crime lab. You can check that out and all of the stories that we have been discussing today at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. George Pyle, Benjamin Wood, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, our operations and programming director. Also to the folks up at Utah Public Radio in Logan and to the show's producer, Emily Means. And of course, to our partner in this program, the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this and all of our other local shows at our website, kcpw.org, or on iTunes or however you get your podcasts. And you can catch up with KCPW on Facebook at KCPW88.3. Once again, thanks for joining us here on Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend.
If you know Richard Reed Perry at all, it's probably as a member of Arcade Fire, where he's that, you know, 9-foot-tall guy banging on garbage cans with the red hair. But in his own time, he explores contemporary classical music, Japanese death poems, and British folk. It's coming up on Q from PRI, or Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio. And programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Vineyards at Mount Naomi Farms wedding and event venue located at 4460 North, 400 East in Hyde Park, offering a finished barn for indoor events and open grass areas for outdoor parties with views of Cache Valley. Details at the Vineyards at mtnaomifarms.com.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM Logan, also heard online at upr.org.